My jaw kind of drops at Claire and what she admits to. She has a striking honesty that I think is rare. You know, when she talks about motherhood, you know, when she says, I don't find it as fulfilling as it's supposed to be. That's shocking. And yet when she says it, you really feel like it's her truth. And she admits at one point that she will do nearly anything to get what she wants. And directly after that, she's talking about being unsafe, you know. And I feel like with Claire, she provides the audience with an opportunity to see that we are never completely one thing, even at one time. And I think that's a relief to see that on screen, because that's who we are. And I think sometimes stories that are committed to celluloid sort of want to be neat and give hope. And in giving hope, I think they should be neat and tidy and pleasant. And to me, those aren't the stories that give hope. The stories that give hope is to lay bare us all in our messiness and still see our humanity and our goodness shine through.
Hello, and welcome to The Awardist from Entertainment Weekly, taking you inside this year's top contenders for the Oscars and more of the industry's biggest awards. I'm Clarissa Cruz, EW's executive editor. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Josh Rothkopf, EW's senior movies editor. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Clarissa. Today, we're going to bring you our interview with actress Ruth Negga, whose galvanizing performance in Passing is already garnering her awards and Oscar buzz. Passing, a black and white indie set in Harlem during the Jazz Age, is the directorial debut of actress Rebecca Hall, who makes an unusually sensitive and intellectually ambitious foray into directing on a subject that's rarely explored on screen, the idea of hiding in plain sight and pretending to be a person of a different race. Ruth Negga did superb work in 2016's Loving, for which she was both Oscar and Golden Globe nominated.
More broadly, we're going to discuss the status of the Best Supporting Actress race right now, the frontrunners, the potential nominees on the bubble, and other factors that could affect the race as we head into the thick of award season. This is a category with a lot of incredible talent in it, isn't it, Josh?
Oh, absolutely.
What did you think of Passing?
I love Passing, and right now we're kind of grappling with the idea of another Sundance that's going to be all virtual that was just announced the other day.
I know.
Right? Last Sundance. In 2021, we saw Passing. It debuted at Sundance. And I remember of all the films I was streaming on my couch, Passing was one of the few that really stayed with me. And I found myself thinking about it a lot. It's such an incredible indie. It's such a beautiful vision from Rebecca Hall. But the performances in it, particularly Ruth, but also Tessa Thompson, are really the anchors of the film. It's a film that's kind of built of these very subtle moments and inflections. A lot of it is nonverbal looks and exchanges and secrecies. It's the kind of thing that an actor who is sensitive to performance would want to make. So I understand why Rebecca Hall would choose this kind of a subject, because it really is putting a lot of the primacy of the force of the film on the performances, which it must have been incredibly fun to make. And I know that Ruth in our interview talks about the making of this film. I would love her to break into the bracket on this one. I do find myself wondering who you think are the leading contenders right now in terms of Best Supporting Actress for the Oscar race.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of Kirsten Dunst, and in Power of the Dog, she's fantastic. I also feel like she's one of those people that people want to reward. I mean, she's had such a long and varied career, and is just such a great actress. And I think this particular role, where she plays a woman who's married into this sort of dysfunctional family and terrorized by Benedict Cumberbatch's character, and it's a quiet role, but it's so powerful in that quietness. I'm sensing a theme here, because there's a lot of quiet, but like powerfully quiet, because we're talking about this with Ruth as well. But yeah, I think Kirsten has a good shot. And I mean, just speaking of quiet, this is something I wanted to ask you getting back to Passing. I mean, that definitely is a slow burn of a movie, mm-hmm. as I think Power of the Dog is too. I mean, what do you think about people maybe not having the attention span for something like this, especially, you know, these are both Netflix movies, watching it at home. There's a very tempting pause button and you know, being distracted by your phone. You know, what do you think that effect has on movies like this?
Well, obviously, it's not great. I mean, I'm distracted by my kitchen. I'm distracted by all. And it's, yes, that pause button comes in handy. Although I have to say, when it came to Sundance, I really tried hard to kind of dim the lights and lean in a little bit and give the films
right.
the best shot they could. But you're absolutely right. I mean, when you're talking about a movie like Passing, there is something to be said for sitting in a theater and really submitting to the experience without distractions.
Right.
But Passing was one of the few titles that worked for me in that regard. I understand what you mean about Power of the Dog, which is so, it's such a feast of filmmaking and the cinematography and Johnny Greenwood's music and all the performances really are so beautifully orchestrated that it's almost a shame to watch something like that at home, even with the lights up. But
right.
I totally agree with you about Kirsten Dunst, by the way. I feel like I've been waiting for her to do a performance like this for her whole career. She went through a phase where she seemed like she was kind of like narcotized or drugged, you know, like she played a lot of characters who were kind of sleepy. And I mean, by design, she's always had great chops, but there's something about the way she weaponizes her vulnerability in The Power of the Dog
yeah.
that I found fascinating. And it's just like that performance. And
great
also
way of putting it.
Yeah. I mean, the way she is counterpoised against these very aggressive men in the film, as somebody who could be exploited, and our hearts go out to her. I mean, that's really what makes her performance so dazzling. I've been waiting for her to take the vulnerability that you see in something like Virgin Suicides and wed it to this. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a silent performance. Like it's a lot of shots of her face.
Yeah.
Her character becomes an alcoholic. So it's a lot of shots of her sneaking away to drink. And I mean, I was rapt by her in that. Another performance that I think we should probably talk about in the context of front runners would be Katrina Balfe in Belfast, mm-hmm. which I understand. Mm-hmm. I know that you're not as huge a fan of Belfast as I am. I do think that she is, maybe it's something that we can agree on. As sentimental as that film can be, she is easily the best part about it. She's the most sincere part about it. She plays, Belfast is Kenneth Branagh's memoir about his boyhood and growing up in Ireland during the Troubles in the late 60s and early 70s. And she plays his mother or a version of his mother. And she, in turn, over the course of the film, sometimes has to be courageous, sometimes has to be a disciplinarian, is always loving and concerned about the kids, but also has to sort of protect them in basically a war zone. And she's a romantic character as well. She has a marriage that seems strong, but also at times is strained. There are money issues.
Yeah.
And I feel like over the course of the film, we're really getting a full portrait of mother during this time. I thought she was terrific in the film.
I agree. I thought she was great. I thought she was a big part of the heart of that movie. I mean, just watching it, and you touched on this a little bit, you know, the portrayal of motherhood, totally get it. Totally understand. The one scene though, the one scene where she sends her kid back, like in a riot to like return that box of cereal or whatever that he stole from the store. I was like, no mother would send her. I get the whole lesson. You know, if my kids stole something, I would send them back too, but probably not in the middle of a riot. That might be pushing me. I get the dramatic liberty there, and I thought it was a really well done scene. But just part of me in the back of my mind was like, I wouldn't do that. But that's nothing. That's not to take away from her performance. I thought she was fantastic. Jumping to another movie, Anjanou Ellis in King Richard. I mean, my goodness. I think that, you know, as much as Will Smith is getting a lot of attention for that role, I mean, Anjanou is the backbone of that movie, I think. I mean, she just sort of grounds the family. I think her scenes with Will are so powerful and electric. And I just thought she was fantastic in the movie. The kitchen scene.
The kitchen scene.
If that's not an Oscar clip right there, I don't know what is. That is a scene where Anjanou's character, she plays Venus and Serena Williams' mother, and Will Smith plays their father, Richard Williams, and they just have a standoff in the kitchen, you know, where there is a lot unsaid, but there is so much said in her eyes and in her pain. And I thought that was just a fantastic scene.
Oh, it's, I mean, Oscars, there are Oscar winners who have scenes like that. And I think about Network, right? And I think about all these great, almost one scene winners where they just kind of like do a knockout punch. Anjanou Ellis is like, right, you're watching King Richard and all of a sudden, and, you know, and King Richard is a very inspirational sports movie that is largely by the numbers. I mean, I think it's ennobled by the performances, which are uniformly excellent. Will Smith is as good as he's ever been. But when that scene happens and it's like a marital standoff in the kitchen, all of a sudden the register of the film gets so much more sophisticated. And she's actually helping him with his performance in that scene and making his character much more complex than we've heretofore seen in watching the movie. And I just, all of a sudden you lean in and you realize, oh, here's someone who was not going to be accepting the sort of a steadfast wife role, even if the role was written to some degree that way, they accommodated room for Anjanou to really deepen and shade it and make it into someone who is maybe not as much of a ham as Richard was, right? Didn't hog the limelight and wasn't as boisterous as much of a braggart, but at the same time had real concerns about parenting and how they were raising their kids and his own failings as a father and a husband. Yeah. That scene is incredible.
Yeah. It's not in what she says because, you know, there are like these lines of, you know, about another family, like she kind of hints at it, but you see all of the pain in her. I mean, if you were to just read the dialogue of that scene, there are hints to what some of those failings were on his part, but you really get the full sense of the impact on the family when you watch her.
Absolutely. And I think that we would be remiss if we didn't at least mention, as far as leading contenders, two actresses from West Side Story, Ariana DeBose and Rita Moreno, who I think has a narrative here that would just be hard to resist for Oscarologists interested in this. She is somebody who won an Oscar famously in 1961 for West Side Story. So that was 60 years ago, almost exactly. Mm-hmm. And the idea of her being nominated again for a performance that I think it's a very sensitive and quiet one. We have a beautiful interview with Rita in the forthcoming issue, correct? In February?
Mm-hmm.
And she is talking about how she had a very specific idea for her interpretation of this character that was written for her, Valentina, as someone who is interpreting West Side Story's very famous song, Somewhere, but interpreting it in a slightly angrier way.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a fascinating reading. And she does some great acting, some very subtle acting in that scene. And then there's Ariana DeBose, who has, I think, one of the most electric performances in the film. She plays Anita, so that's the role that Rita played in the original. And it's just a show-stopping kind of a role. And Ariana just won the Los Angeles Film Critics Award for Best Supporting Actress. So you could say that she is certainly a front runner in the race.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a question, and I hope I'm not putting you on the spot here, Josh, but whenever there are two actors in a category, how has that worked historically as far as vote splitting? Because I think my initial reaction is, okay, you know, people love this movie. Is it going to be a disadvantage to have two people nominated in the same slot? I'm kind of also seeing, you know, if this happens in Belfast with Jamie Dornan and Kieran Hines, it's like, would two actors in the same movie in the same slot split the vote? Or does it not matter if there's enough love for one performance?
I think that it's always so hard to know definitively, but I think as a general rule, having too many actors in those supporting categories diffuses the concentration of votes. I mean, this is something that happened I think famously with The Godfather, where you have so many incredible performances on the periphery of that and so many nominated performances. The idea that James Caan didn't win Best Supporting Actor for The Godfather is kind of shocking when you think about how great that performance is. Not to mention Robert Duvall or you know, Marlon Brando eventually did win, but it's kind of one person will prevail, obviously. There will only be one person who's victorious.
Right.
But I think that that's where the idea of category fraud, that's something that people talk about these days, where a savvy distributor or studio will try to place the performances in the category they want them to be in or will have the most success in, because maybe they won't be competing against someone else in the same film. I mean, there's no... I mean, what would Aristotle say? There's no way that you can say that that Anita is the lead of the film. The leads of the film are Maria and Tony in West Side Story.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, I think there are both Ariana and Rita Moreno have heat behind them for different reasons. You know, Rita maybe for nostalgia's sake, and Ariana because the performance is just so wonderful. But we'll see how that plays out. I do think that. There are always weird reasons for people getting in. Category fraud is real. Do any of these supporting performances that we've mentioned so far, do you think any of them like transcend the film's leading actors?
I mean, and not to beat on Kirsten again, but like I mean, when I first saw that movie, I felt like a leading role to me because she's in so much of it.
Same.
But yeah, so I think that she was such a worthy scene partner with Benedict. I mean, those scenes where he's terrifying wouldn't have been as terrifying if it weren't for her reactions and her playing of that role. Not that I think that it's category fraud, because I can see, but I also think that that performance is that powerful and could be considered a lead as well. What about you?
Katrina Balfe, I think, also is...
Yes.
That is an example. I mean, if you were telling me the story of Belfast, you would say it's about a heroic mother. I mean, those are the first words out of your mouth that anyone would say. And the idea that this is a supporting, I mean, does that mean that the boy that plays Buddy, the surrogate for Kenneth Branagh, is the lead? I mean, he does a fine job, I guess.
Yeah.
But Katrina Balfe's performance is so head and shoulders above anyone in that movie. And she has so much screen time, and her husband, who's played by Jamie Dornan, disappears for a while in the middle of the film, goes off to England for a job, and she's holding down the fort. I mean, this really is a leading performance, but you know, for whatever reason, she is being considered in the supporting actress category. And it's a category that if Belfast continues to gather steam, it's an audience favorite, although there aren't a lot of audiences right now during Omicron.
Right. I know.
But if it continues to gather steam from crowds, I mean, Belfast could have a really good night at the Oscars, but we'll see. Are there any dark horses, or do you have a personal favorite maybe who's on the bubble or maybe even outside the conversation who you wish was more in it?
Yeah. Of course, no podcast will go by without mentioning The Lost Daughter, because that's like such. I swear I'm not on Netflix's payroll. I love
it's
this movie,
good.
And it's that good, and I love every actress in it. I want to advocate for Dakota Johnson. Obviously, Olivia Colman's fantastic. I think Jesse Buckley is fantastic. I mean, they're just so many great performances in this movie, but Dakota Johnson, I just found her so edgy and flinty and mesmerizing every time she was on screen. And it's a performance that I've never seen from her. And I thought she was so great. I mean, I feel like every time she was on screen, there was just that extra little element of danger, and you're not exactly sure what she's thinking or what she's capable of. And also, you know, it's not just that. She also brings a very relatable view of motherhood and how overwhelming and relentless it can be. And she does it in a way that's super subtle and I think believable. And I think those two parts of her performance are really well done. You know,
absolutely.
Like, I think it's hard to, she could just be like this sort of dangerous, mysterious, like femme fatale kind of person, but she also layers that with a very realistic depiction of motherhood.
I'm 100% with you on that train, that lost daughter train. And I do think that Dakota Johnson that's another example of the kind of performance that helps to shade the leading performance. Olivia Colman is so, complex in that film. But Dakota Johnson, it's so interesting. I watch her and she's a young mother grappling with the demands of it. She's kind of messy and distracted and depressed. And it's because she is all of those things and still kind of maintaining her poise that you begin to understand perhaps the background a little bit of Olivia Colman's character, because she looks at her on the beach and she recognizes herself, a younger version of herself. And then we, of course, also see in that movie Jesse Buckley, who is a younger version of Olivia Colman's character. And I think Jesse Buckley's performance is my favorite of the film. I mean, that shows someone who very much wants to prioritize her own loves and passions, and at the same time has a family, and there's a pulling apart. And to watch Dakota Johnson and Jesse Buckley in The Lost Daughter is really to understand Olivia Colman's character, and also gives Olivia Colman latitude to go very dark. Again, we're not going to spoil anything for you, but this is a movie that explores an unusual subject. And I think the supporting performances give it the breadth that we get excited about. As far as another performance I think that we could add, and as a dark horse, I'm crazy about Gabby Hoffman in Come On, Come On.
Me too.
I could watch a whole movie. She plays Joaquin Phoenix's sister. Joaquin Phoenix and Woody Norman, they play uncle and nephew. And so the film is primarily about them. But Gabby Hoffman is so persuasive as a sibling to Joaquin Phoenix. I feel like if enough people see
Joaquin, look like siblings.
They look like siblings. Sure. They have the same kind of angularity, the same braininess. They have a kind of verbal believability. And she is, her performance is really one that I think allows him to go to places that he wouldn't have gone to. I would love to see some kind of a Phoenix effect happen. If you are watching Come On, Come On for Joaquin Phoenix, notice the person playing his sister and give her your attention. She's great.
Right. Yeah, she's fantastic. And before we wrap and go on to our wonderful interview with Ruth Negga, can we just touch on Cate Blanchett really quickly? Because yes. I think she has two really fantastic supporting performances, one in Nightmare Alley and one in Don't Look Up. And they're both mesmerizing for different reasons, but I think we'd be remiss to not mention her here.
Absolutely. Because
I think they're such different roles, but she just nails both of them, I think.
The kind of range that she has at this point in her career, she can take us. I mean, in Nightmare Alley, she's playing this kind of swanky, mysterious, noirish. That really is a femme fatale, but also kind of hiding how far ahead she is of Bradley Cooper's character, yes. and so smart and so obviously the one in control and having all the power in that film, which is a thriller and very voluptuous in terms of its style. But Cate is I think the hottest point of contact in terms of her performance. And then the way that she, I mean, I feel, you know, that I'm not a huge fan of Don't Look Up, but I do feel that among that entire cast, Cate is the one that seems to understand the brief here, I think, the best. Like she's the one that's pushing it into that kind of like fizzy, strange love type satire where it needs to be. I wish the whole movie was on the same wave like that she was, but playing a sort of an anchor along with Tyler Perry and having that kind of glibness that she was able to summon with him almost immediately is just, it's just incredible chops. I mean, that's a great.
It's all in the teeth. Speaking of chops, all in the teeth. All in the teeth. But on that note, when we come back, we have our wonderful interview with Ruth Negga, star of Passing.
No one knew more about gel coat.
When the fourth round would...
Don't you call in the...
Don't
touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here, because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers, every Thursday starting April 4th, as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with The Awardist podcast, Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/awardist.
Welcome back to The Awardist. Ruth Negga joined us at the Savannah Film Festival in Georgia to talk about her film Passing, which is now streaming on Netflix. Here's Ruth on the subject of Passing itself.
It happens so often, and yet we know so little about it. The word passing is not in the everyday lexicon. Do you know what I mean? And it's interesting, you know, when I think about it a lot now, I think passing as in a death. You know, passing on into the next world, because it is like that. And it does feel like this person is sort of going onto a journey, you know, over the river Styx into an underworld, because it is an underworld they're entering into, because it's a world of secrecy.
Ruth's character Claire haunted her. Here she is on characters that can sometimes haunt an actor.
There are a few characters that I think linger with you and sort of leave their mark on you, a residue, if you will. And they're actually it's very welcome. And Claire is one of those. I think, well, her function in the book, really, if I can use that word function, it's so boring, but it's true, is to unsettle, disrupt, create chaos. And I think that kind of vibrancy of that energy, I think it's very hard to embody and then discard, which I love, because I loved playing someone like that. I loved playing someone who was so unapologetic about all of themselves, you know? I mean, in the film, as in the book, there are several instances when, you know, my jaw kind of drops at Claire and what she admits to. But for her, it's, she has a striking honesty that I think is rare. You know, when she talks about motherhood, you know, when she says, I don't find it as fulfilling as it's supposed to be. That's shocking. And yet when she says it, you really feel like it's her truth. And also when she says, she admits at one point that she will do nearly anything to get what she wants. And directly after that, she's talking about being unsafe, you know. And I feel like with Claire, she provides the audience with an opportunity to see that we are never completely one thing, even at one time. You know, and I think that's a relief to see that on screen, because that's who we are. And I think sometimes stories that are committed to celluloid sort of want to be neat and give hope. And in giving hope, I think they should be neat and tidy and pleasant. And to me, those aren't the stories that give hope. The stories that give hope is to lay bare us all in our messiness and still see our humanity and our goodness shine through.
Here's Ruth on working with Tessa Thompson and on the value of feeling safe to explore any subject on a set.
Fearless isn't just something one person, an individual, generates in themselves. It has to be an environmental thing. And I very much believe in that. And with that comes a sense of camaraderie and fun. And we laughed a lot on set. And I think that is sort of a release, if you will, for the tension and the subject matter. And I think that is crucial. It's when you're doing sort of, you know, things that are very sort of emotionally trying, that is essential. And luckily, Tessa's like that. We giggled an awful lot. And, you know, these two characters are really sort of, they're so deeply connected to one another that you do start thinking they're the same person. I did. You know, I even went so far as to sort of muse on if Claire is a sort of coping mechanism, figment of her imagination, you know, an outlet, if you will. And so they're so dependent on one another, and so our performances were going to be, had to be, if we were going to tell it the story truthfully. And so the being open and vulnerable to one another as performers, but as individuals, was key and crucial. And I think, you know, we very much created that spirit of safetiness between us and that spirit of connectedness. And I know I feel like there's so I mean, no performance can be really done individually, but I think I'm drawn to, and this certainly was, my performance was very reliant on her. And I think vice versa. And that's a really fun, lovely, sort of liberating place to be, you know.
Here's Ruth on her director, Rebecca Hall. Also, she speaks about her producers, Forrest Whitaker and Nina Yang Bongiovi.
Rebecca is an amazing performer, and she has this combination of intellectual curiosity and also a more visceral curiosity, and the two together are really quite extraordinary. And, you know, knowing a bit about her familial history and our connection to the concept, the practice of passing, her passion, I found it intoxicating. She knew what she wanted. She wanted a black and white 4-3 ratio, and she wanted two women of color leading it. I mean, when she said that some people were suggesting maybe not, I still didn't understand how that would work, but anyway. But she stuck to her guns, and she found in Forrest and Nina people who were willing to not only like take that on, but like champion it. And I think if we had more people like that in the industry, you know, supporting these voices, we could do anything. We could go anywhere. That to me is thrilling. But you know, and I like working with people like Rebecca, especially directors like Rebecca, who understand the collaborative nature of this endeavor of filmmaking, because it's really hard. But, you know, I felt like she felt everyone was equals and everyone was treated as such, and everyone had a say and everyone had a contribution to make, and it was fully valued. And that's beautiful to see.
Thank you, Ruth. And special thanks to senior editor Brittany Kaplan for conducting the interview. Passing is currently streaming now on Netflix.
And that's it for this episode of The Awardist. If you liked what you heard, subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave us an award-winning review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation with us going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials at EW on Twitter and Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at ClarissaNYC1 and Josh Rothkopf. We'll see you next week.
This episode of The Awardist podcast is hosted by Clarissa Cruz and Josh Rothkopf. Produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio. Executive produced by Shayna Crockmall. Edited and mixed by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.